Welcome to Water for Fighting. We discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This episode's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator, protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at seaandshoreline.com. And of course, Res. Res is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at res.us. If you enjoy the discussions here on Water for Fighting, I think you'll also want to check out the Florida Specifier and the Florida Specifier podcast. Specifier has become Florida's environmental news source of record, and the podcast is your go-to place for staying up to speed on environmental news and newsmakers here in the Sunshine State. You can join the discussion as we explore the latest environmental news and developments that matter to you. Go to www.floridaspecifier.com to check it out. All right, I'm excited to be sitting here with my friend, colleague, and former boss, Herschel Vineyard. Herschel may not be a Florida native, but at this point, he spent over half his life in Florida. So I think he's earned his stripes as an official Florida man. He's a lawyer by training, and he spent his undergrad and law school at Louisiana State University. He served as a secretary of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, where he was my boss. And he's currently the partner in charge, and help me if I get this wrong, Herschel, the partner in charge of the Amazon Reese Law Firm in Jacksonville.
And a little bit in Tallahassee, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, when you're in the building, that's for sure. Yes, the Specifier Studio is actually a sublease from Adams and Reese, so we appreciate you letting us house ourselves here.
It's all about collaboration.
Herschel, thanks so much for spending a little time with me to talk about your life and experiences. I've always known you as a Louisiana guy. Am I saying it right? Louisiana? Okay.
Depends on what part of the state you're from.
Well, I mean, break it down for me.
So it's Louisiana, if you're north of Alexandria, the northern half of the state, it's Louisiana. If you're in kind of the Cajun area.
Okay. So they actually...
The southern part.
I would have thought it would be the opposite almost for some reason, like with the extra Cajun draw, but what do I know, right? Yeah. I'm learning something already. Look at us. But your life didn't actually begin there. Your story actually began in Texas, but before I jump to Herschel joining the scene. Let's talk about your parents a little bit, because they are from Louisiana?
Louisiana.
Okay. Yeah. And so I want to make sure what side of the state we're on. And then talk about how they met, and then they ended up in Texas somehow, and we'll get to that. But tell me about your mom and dad.
Sure. My dad is from LaSalle Parish, which is in the northern part of the state, kind of a largely agriculture area. My mom's from Ruston, Louisiana, which happens to be the home of Louisiana Tech University. And that's where they met. My dad was on a football and academic scholarship, Louisiana Tech. My mom grew up in Ruston, and they met. My mom was a freshman, and my dad was captain of the football team.
I want to talk about that a little bit because, I always try to do a little extra homework, and I've known you for a while. It's like, but I did not know that your dad played football at Louisiana Tech. What position did he play?
Well, at the time, you played both sides of the ball, so he was an offensive and defensive tackle.
Wow. And I was looking, and you have some famous, very famous personalities and athletes that went to Louisiana Tech. Two of them on the football team. I guess one's known for as a TV personality and the other as one of the greatest quarterbacks ever. So you had Terry Bradshaw on one side, but you also had Phil Robertson, who's the Duck Dynasty guy, right?
Yes, they make the Duck Commander duck calls as well. And
right.
So I had one before they got famous.
And you and I talked, texted a little bit at one point. And you said your dad and them knew each other, because they followed your dad. Your dad, I think, graduated in the early 60s, is that right?
That's right. And so both Terry Bradshaw and Phil Robertson came in maybe a couple of years after he was gone, but he still visited the program a lot. It was the same head coach. You know, you didn't have all the folks moving around like today. And I do remember my dad saying that Phil Robertson was quite a talented quarterback. But if the Ducks were flying, he didn't come out of the woods for the football game. So that gave Terry Bradshaw an opportunity.
Right. I saw the numbers, and Robertson's numbers were better the first, you know, for the first season each of them played. I think Terry found his stride eventually, obviously, but that's what they said. He quit football to hunt ducks. And so I guess that, you know, is what it is.
He followed his passion, and oddly enough, I read recently that the Robertson family is now worth $400 million.
Oh, my.
So the duck call business kind of worked for him.
It seems so. It's like, I didn't know there were that many people that hunted ducks. I've done it a few times, and not a fan. It's a lot of roaming about in the water and in the cold, so not my thing. What was your mom and dad's passion? Why was he at, so you said academic scholarship. What did he study, and what did your mom study at Tech?
So my dad was a chemical engineer, graduated in chemical engineering, and my mom graduated in social work. Mm. I think that was maybe customary at the time. I mean, I guess it's a little unusual for women to go to college at that time, but she mm-hmm. went through, got her degree, and married my dad.
Did she go on to work in social work, or was she more of a stay-at-home mom?
She was a stay-at-home mom. Our family was a little bit like Leave It to Beaver, where my dad got up, went to work. My mom took care of me.
Yeah, I had one of those moms too, which was really nice, and also sometimes not nice because you had to face the music all the time at home. And so what took them, because I want to get to the growing up part, what took them to Texas?
So my dad received an offer from Texas Eastman. Eastman Kodak was, I think, the parent company. Mm-hmm. And there's a large chemical plant in Longview, Texas.
What part of Texas is that?
Northeast okay. Texas on I-20. So if you think, I was born on I-20, my mom in Ruston, Ruston's on I-20, and my dad is just a little bit south of I-20.
Okay. And he did what there?
In his younger days, he was a plant, whatever chemical engineers do right. in a plant. I don't know. Exactly. I was, you know, 5 years old.
Right, right. So, I guess that's my next question is, you're old enough at least then to remember Longview.
Oh, yeah. So I was born there, and Exxon Chemical lured my dad away to the Houston area at the end of my seventh grade year.
Okay.
And so it was a big move, kind of painful. You know, you're in middle school, mm-hmm. junior high, it was called at the time, and got to make a whole new set of friends.
I think it's, you know, I know it's the way it is now, but back then, Houston must have been a bigger town than Longview.
Oh, goodness, yes, yes. We were up close, Longview's closer to Dallas, mm. so Houston, being on the Gulf Coast, was completely different environment.
Tell me about that a little bit. Were you a sports kid, a hunting kid, a fishing kid, a boating kid, all of that?
All of the above. My dad was very, very active. In I'm from a family of three boys, so mm. I have two brothers, and we were constantly doing ball games. My dad, because he was a superior athlete, did a lot of coaching when we were younger, mm-hmm. and so baseball and basketball, and we spent a lot of time with both my folks, but on the outside, or the outdoor side, my dad was active, and so we would go camping and then go fishing and go duck hunting with our duck commander duck calls, and nice. Just had a wonderful, wonderful upbringing.
What's the difference between that kind of outdoor recreation from Longview to Houston? Is there something that people do more of in one place that they don't do in the other?
Well, sure. So until seventh grade, I'd only really done saltwater fishing on vacation when we would go mm. to what we called Florida, which is the panhandle of Florida. And so it was all freshwater up around Longview. But as we moved to the Houston area, we had a different kind of boat to allow us to go out in the bay and do saltwater fishing.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on, you know, mostly, I mean, not that far away from the saltwater, but it may as well have been a million miles, you know, when you're East Hillsborough County. It's not that long, but it's like you spend all your time around, you know, freshwater rivers and springs and things like that. And so it was a big, you know, change for me, you know, coming up here, living in the Panhandle for the last, well, over 20 years, off and on to do more of that saltwater fishing. Different life altogether.
Different life. The hunting was different as well. At the time, there were a number of rice fields surrounding Houston, and so that tended to make for good goose hunting.
Interesting. I want to talk about you as a kid, as maybe a student early on. I always have this picture in my mind of you as a, you know, 8-9-year-old kid, you know, third, fourth grade spelling bee, wearing a seersucker suit, you know, and just dominating. What were you like in terms of school as a young kid? Did you like it, or was your focus always on what came after school?
I enjoyed school, but it's where my friends were.
Right.
And so I never really wanted to be sick, because then I couldn't go to school and be with my friends. So, yeah. But yeah, I still wear the same clothes, kind of the styles that my mom dressed me in when I was six. And so I still enjoy wearing white bucks only after Easter, just like I did when I was a kid.
I like it. What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you have any concept of that at all?
Oh, of course. I wanted to be a professional football player.
Sure. Did you play football?
I played up until the first year or two of high school, but what I found that I was really good at was long distance running. And I figured that I would focus on that when my football coach said, "Vineyard, if we had a 1 mile pass route, you'd be deadly."
That's good. Oh boy. How did you end up deciding to go to LSU and not become a Bulldog like your parents? A
couple of reasons. One, I did some recruiting trips in high school for track and cross country, and one of my visits was to LSU. I still have a lot of family in Baton Rouge, and my grandfather actually played football for LSU, so we had some ties. And so many of my friends went to Texas or A&M, Baylor, and I decided I didn't want to just hang out with them when I left for college. So I went over to LSU not knowing anybody.
Yeah, I think I pictured in my mind that you would, you know, go, your family moves you back to Ruston, and you know, and then you settle in there, and then it's this giant betrayal to go to LSU. And I was ready for that bit of controversy, but it's much more.
My parents let me make that decision. It's interesting, because now we all are so focused on where our kids are going to go to college, and lots of trips and pressure, and I just decided I wanted to go to LSU, and they said, okay.
Did you run track and cross country at LSU?
I did not. I can tell you, it is a full-time job for any college athletic program, whether you're at D1, or my son was a college athlete at the D3 level. It's work.
At least for the ones that are that put the student and student athlete in, you know, and walk away with degrees. What did you study at LSU?
Marketing.
Okay.
So I have a business degree.
Why?
Because I started in accounting, and after a year, I did pretty well, but I couldn't stand it.
Is it the math? Is it the redundancy of it? What is it that?
You had to be very organized.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily my strong suit.
Well, I think you did all right, at least later on. So a blooming potential accountant got a marketing guy. And so obviously what one chooses when they finish that degree is law school. What happened in your mind? It was like, hey, I need to go become a lawyer instead of businessman or accountant or what have you.
I think probably a strong motivating factor was I met my wife when I was a senior in college, and she came from Monroe, Louisiana, which is right near the old Duck Dynasty area, although she makes a distinction of where she grew up versus where they grew up. And so we start dating, and I thought, you know, I kind of like this lady, this girl. And so I wanted to stay in Baton Rouge. Didn't really want to be a manager at Penny's. And so I thought law school would be a great option.
That sounds good. Was she a student at LSU?
She was.
What was she studying?
Elementary education.
Okay. Still on that same kind of par. Talk about after law school. How did the decision-making process go? When did you get married, first of all?
My senior year of law school.
Okay. And so there's decision-making among, you know, between you and your wife about what happens next. What did happen next? Like, what? Because you ended up, ended up in Florida, in Jacksonville?
It was. So my senior year of law school, Louisiana, their political world is, while as exciting as a 20-year-old, when you start thinking about living there full-time as an adult, it's perhaps a little distasteful. So you had a lot of folks going to prison.
Yeah.
And while I love Texas, I did not want to practice law in a city the size of Houston. So my wife and I decided we wanted to stay in a mid-sized city in the South. So I started looking around and sent out some resumes and got a call from Smith & Halsey in Jacksonville, Florida, and went over there, interviewed, and I was fortunate enough to get my first real job, my lawyer job.
Right.
At that law firm. And that was in, so I started there in 1990.
Okay.
And my wife and I were going to be in Florida for a 1-year experiment. And well over 3 decades later, we're still here.
Yeah. I think even that first job, you were a decade, right? 10 years?
Something 10 years. Like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was a young partner there and till a different wind blew.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to that win in a minute. I'm curious, what are the other places that you looked at in terms of that choice-making process of mid-sized cities in the South?
I had an interest in Savannah, Charleston, Mobile. I don't think at the time Tampa was even on my radar screen.
Right. I mean, those are really, you know, really good choices, but I'd be partial to Jacksonville as well. And, you know, in that particular slate, I've seen the others.
It's been a wonderful decision for us.
Yeah, seems like it. Talk about leaving your first job.
So it was kind of out of the blue. So the holding company that ultimately worked for had, they largely in the shipbuilding and ship repair business. And I was active in a group called the First Coast Manufacturers Association.
Okay.
And it's because I did a lot of environmental work for manufacturers. So I was active and got to know one of the executives that was at the shipyard, Atlantic Marine. And he came to me one day out of the blue and said, look, I want to fish full time. Do you want my job? And so it was an interesting way to kind of hop out of the hourly practice of law and do something a little bit different.
I want to explore those differences. I probably should have done it while we were talking a moment ago about your original practice. When leading up to the time that you were leaving, when we say environmental work, what type of work does that mean? Like helping people navigate, you know, whether it's legal disputes over permits, things like that. I mean, give me an idea of what that looks like.
At the time, it was the Superfund law. CERCLA was still kind of new, and Superfund, CERCLA cases, RCRA hazardous waste sites, and also the leaking underground storage tank program.
Right.
All those sites now have matured. There's far fewer of them as the programs have matured and the way people handle material has improved. And so I focused on, if you will, past sins of handling bad things.
Right. A lot of past sins. I mean, how much of that, I'm curious, and you know, I think there's, you know, some of it you said about, you know, some people just not caring what they do. But it seems like maybe before a certain time that people didn't quite understand what kind of damage they could do with with what they were doing, or you know, what was your sense of how that went?
Brett, that's exactly what it was. I mean, you know, you talk, most of these folks have passed away now, but I think it was customary. The way to clear the grass along a fence line was you just poured used mortar oil along there, killed the weeds. And now we know that's not the best thing for the environment.
Right.
And so I don't think it was it was malicious, and I certainly didn't come across with my practice any clients that were trying to be malicious toward the environment or for that matter, even cut corners. It was just lack of knowledge.
We'll call that foreshadowing for what we're going to talk about in a little bit. But let's talk first about then now getting back to the shipyard. What were the differences between what your practice looked like and working with them? Well, first of all, tell me the company. It's a rather longish name, so I couldn't, you know.
Atlantic Marine Holding Company.
Okay.
And so we had shipyards in Jacksonville, which was the first one, then on Mayport Naval Station, which is in Jacksonville, where we did a lot of Navy ship repair. We did Navy ship repair at the Jacksonville Yard as well. And then a very large yard in Mobile, Alabama.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and most of my experience of shipyards is usually like an episode of Starsky and Hutch or something like that. And so I'm curious about the day-to-day part of your involvement in what they do.
It was fantastic. At the time, my son was probably 5 or 6 years old, and it was a real treat to, on occasion, bring him to the shipyard. My daughter, too. Mm-hmm. But when you see a several thousand ton ship out of the water, when you're dealing with what they call it, wheel or propeller, that is twice the size of a human being. It's fun to see something that large. The cranes, obviously, I didn't operate those.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun working with the shipyard workers, working with the industry as well. I was active nationally to promote U.S. shipbuilding and ship repair.
Okay, I like the sound of it.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation.
I want to move on to that part, the foreshadowing part. And I think it begins, I mean, and I basically were glossing over, 10, 11 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. There, yeah. And, you know, I don't mean to, you know, compress it too much, but I want to get to the thing that I'm interested in that I don't think I've ever asked you the question, which was, how did you and Rick Scott, who was the brand new governor at the time, how did y'all find each other? You know, how did he convince you to take one of the most thankless jobs in all of state government? Like, what was that experience at the very beginning?
So I was on Governor-elect Scott's economic development transition team.
Okay.
And so he's getting to know people from around the state. Fortunately, he's got a fantastic memory, and nothing gets by him. But we met, and I took the opportunity to share with him some of the experiences that I had with environmental permitting at the shipyard and the length of time. And I said, you know, that we don't have to lower our environmental standards, but we've got to improve the process by which we arrive at a decision. And if the answer, you're not entitled to a permit, then you shouldn't make that applicant wait 2 years to find out what the answer is.
Right.
And if they're entitled to the permit, then let's get it out the door.
Was that something you had a lot? I mean, tell me about, maybe give me a straw man. It doesn't have to be an actual particular instance, but give me a straw man of what that looked like in your previous role at the...
I'll give you a great example that happened shortly before I arrived at the shipyard. Is the company had a wonderful opportunity, and they applied for an expansion permit to grow the shipyard to be able to accommodate this additional work. And it just delayed and delayed and delayed. And ultimately, the owner of the shipyard at the time went out and bought the shipyard in Mobile, Alabama. And as a result, 1,000 jobs were in Mobile and not in Jacksonville.
Right.
And ultimately, the Jacksonville shipyard got the permit, but that economic opportunity
had passed him
had
by.
Passed him by.
Yeah. So did he say, "Well, I hear you complaining about it. You want to go fix it?" How'd that happen?
He said, "If you know so much about this, why don't you come help me?" And I remember thinking at the time, "Oh boy, I'm the dog that caught the car," because I had been in the seat where you're kind of punished just by the delay.
Right. I think a lot of people's understanding of you, if they have an understanding at all in those days, is I always find it to be a bit two-dimensional, meaning it's like, hey, this is what I read, or this is the impression that somebody else has given me about what Pershal Vineyard thinks, how he works, what he's doing. And what I prefer to do is give you a chance to kind of look back on those days and talk a little bit about how the experience prior to that led into a philosophy of governance. Like, what was the approach? And I think you've already mentioned part of it. And, you know, I bore witness to part of this myself, which was, it is not about lowering environmental standards. The standard is not, should not be set, you know, as a metric of how much money we can extract from a regulated community, but how we can enforce the law and ensure compliance regardless of how that comes across. Can you talk a little bit about like your thought process in getting to there? Some of it's obviously born of that experience, but sometimes being on the other end, you know, it becomes real.
I had a passion for following the law, and that was paramount. You know, sometimes we all have our personal thoughts on, well, that's not a good law or
right.
whatever, but that's not a regulator's job.
Right.
The regulator's job is to follow the law, and I've had more than one legislator emphasize that with a finger in my chest. And so we're going to follow the law, even if we don't like it. And if there's a decision in front of us as a regulator, let's evaluate the facts, figure out what the law is, and make a decision.
What was the approach to the starting point? How did you start to build that team and turn that idea into function?
Well, certainly the agency is a very, very large organization. Nothing happens unless you have a team around you that can focus on the mission. I moved over to Tallahassee, at least during the week, and interviewed a number of people and met some folks that I'm friends with today that I didn't hire. You know, Tallahassee's a small town, and so that was obviously the primary pool of applicants. But we were fortunate that we had folks from around the state that were interested in helping Governor Scott achieve his vision.
He gave you a lot of leeway, more so than I'd witnessed before. And I'd been in the governor's office and seen what that relationship has looked like. And sometimes you get a little bit more slack than others. He seemed to give you a lot of room, Was that because you were so tightly affixed to what that mission looked like? Or did he just say, like, hey, you know, Herschel knows what he's doing. It'll be fine. Let him run.
Well, I had nothing to compare it to because that was the first time that I'd been an agency head.
Right.
Obviously, I was a Tallahassee outsider or somebody that did not grow up within state government. And so I had nothing to compare it to. I committed to him that I'd follow the law and I'd work hard and focus on protecting the environment efficiently.
So getting outside of that regulatory sphere, because that's one silo of the department, how did you find yourself adapting and governing the other parts that are inside of DEP, the state park system, Everglades and other ecosystem restoration work? How did you find yourself adapting to thinking about working on communicating effectively about those other things?
So I had to quickly learn about Everglades. That was something that folks that surround themselves around I-10, they aren't as focused on Everglades.
That's right.
But I realized that was an important part of our state's economy and the environment, and wanted to get my hands around it. I do remember that at the time, the state was in a free fall economically, and we had spent in 2010 well over $1 million in outside attorney's fees fighting the federal government for lower water quality standards. And I thought, well, this doesn't make any sense. And there's got to be a solution other than spending a pile of money on lawyers fighting the United States of America.
Right.
I was fortunate we had a lady by the name of Melissa Meeker come join us, and her team developed what's called restoration strategies, which was a suite of projects designed to improve the water quality in the Everglades. And they worked very, very hard. And it was difficult to get over the finish line. There's a whole cottage industry of people that make their living on fighting over Everglades. And actually trying to solve the problem was a little bit unique for them. And then we had to work with then the Obama administration, President Obama, and Region 4, and even the EPA folks in D.C., to convince them that this suite of projects was going to make a significant improvement in water quality. We got over the finish line, and again, it was a team effort. Obviously, it was you. It was Melissa Meeker and her folks. It was Greg Munson. So many people that know the Everglades backwards and forwards put together these projects. I'll skip ahead. It was about a 10-year very expensive effort, and Drew Bartlett, who's now running the South Florida Water Management District, invited me to the ribbon cutting of the final project. It's probably one of the few Everglades projects where they finished them all on time, under budget, and guess what? They worked.
It's fun when they work, because then you get to say, hey, here's where your money went.
That's right.
That's a good thing. Are you all told, like in net, are you happy that you served as secretary?
Yes. Probably when I told the governor that I would stay through his reelection, and I did, and I was out of gas. I wanted to make a difference. I worked very, very hard to do that. I was away from my family because I commuted. My wife stayed back in Jacksonville, and so I was back and forth on I-10, which is tiring. But after about 30 days of me being finished at DEP, I had my batteries charged. I learned 40 years worth of stuff in 4 years and made so many wonderful lifelong friends.
Did it serve as confirmation of everything that you thought before you went in, or is it a little more complicated? Which is like you maybe discover a little bit more nuance going on. Let you see around the corner where I'm getting at, which is, I think when it comes to the regulatory stuff, it seems like you'd done enough of that work where you knew what you were getting into when you got there, and it was just a matter of how do you move a battleship in a different direction. on the other parts of government there, what were your impressions leaving that were different than when you started about what the department does, how it does its work?
This is a very large organization. Mm-hmm. And I do think that Governor Scott benefited from the fact that he had run other organizations, maybe not of the size of state of Florida government, but it sure helps to have managed an organization, because it is a, as you said, is a big battleship to turn. One person can't do it. Governor Scott set the tone for a more efficient government, and I tried to do the same. Again, you know, Jeff Littlejohn, bringing mm-hmm. him on the regulatory side. The state parks and state lands were not as large of a focus, but primarily because the state was broke. You remember, yes. We had no money, and I can't fault the legislature when their constituents were losing their homes at the time.
Yeah.
And say, oh, well, we're going to take some more money from you to buy land mm-hmm. for conservation. It was a tough time. I think 2011, when Governor Scott took over, the state of Florida was borrowing money from the federal government just for operational costs.
Oof. It had been the first time that I could recall, and I'd only been at that point in government for 10 years, but it was the first time I could recall a real discussion, hearing in places like the House of Representatives among Republicans of, you know, increasing fees, increasing taxes, and being serious about it. Meaning we've got to figure out not just the kind of talk we have now, which is, hey, let's be fiscally conservative with our spending and save some, you know, save this for a rainy day, which makes a whole bunch of sense. It was, we don't take in as much money as we need to pay our bills at this moment, and so now we got to go find more money. You know, I guess it goes back to what you were saying about Governor Scott and having some experience in how do you deal with something when you have to figure out how to make dollars stretch farther than they did before. But it's got to be a tough thing to do in your position of going in, knowing that you get to be the disappointer in chief when it comes to, you know, environmental stuff.
Certainly, it's not fun when I guess folks were accustomed to having $100-200 million
right
to buy conservation land. Although I did feel a little bit like somebody that picked up the tab after a big party. They all left. I was the only one there to pay the bills because we had bonded a lot of the acquisition of conservation lands. And so while I had no money, or the department had no money to acquire land, the bills continued to pay off the bonds, continued to arrive on DEP's ledger.
Right. I think that number is getting smaller over the years, but I think we still have another, 6 years yet before all those retire. But that's the great part of having a little bit more pocket change for the state to walk around.
Certainly the state's doing very well, I think, from an economic standpoint. And Governor Scott, this isn't front page news in the sense that the average folk in Florida focus on, but he started paying down debt. We were highly leveraged. And like I said, it probably doesn't get any votes, but it was the right thing to do from a fiscal standpoint.
Yeah. Let's move you out of DEP. Was it a straight shot from the department straight into Adams and Reese back in Jacksonville?
No. I promised myself and my wife that I would take 2 months off. And so I was able to spend Christmas without checking, at the time, my BlackBerry. I was able to enjoy life because I'd been working hard from the time that I got out of school. We had the opportunity to be together, hang out with our parents, and then I joined Foley and Lardner.
Oh, that's right. Look at my memory. Well, I'll skip over those guys. Not that they're bad, and like they're good folks. But I want to talk about Adams and Reese. I want to talk about your practice now. And I want to, you know, kind of pick your brain a little bit, because you've done a lot of writing and speaking on some subjects that I think people would be interested in hearing about. Why Adams and Reese then? Why that landing spot?
It's really interesting about how maybe life goes full circle. The fellow that recruited me to Florida back in 1989 was a guy by the name of Tim Volpe. And lo and behold, Tim Volpe was chairman of Adams and Reese nationally. It's a national law firm. And so he recruited me again. We remained friends for the 3 decades, even though we had not worked together since 2000. We hung out some, and just he's a dear, dear friend to this day. So he wanted to bring me on board. And it's a firm that actually started in Louisiana, New Orleans first, and then Baton Rouge. And now we go, I say we're a Southeastern Conference firm. We go as far west as Texas, and then throughout the South all the way up, and we've got a substantial Washington, D.C. practice.
Okay. We know that you're the partner in charge. What does that mean?
I get to make more decisions than the other partners.
I hear you. I mean, I know part of what you do. And part of it is, I think, built on what we're working on now, nearly 3.5 decades plus of experience. And that's something that not a lot of people in this state that can be helpful or that want to be helpful, I'm not sure, in terms of how to cope with relationships between state level government, local governments, private businesses, and their government, especially at the federal level. And that's the Army Corps of Engineers, that's U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but you've kind of found this niche in there. I don't call it a niche. I mean, it's a big niche, but you've shown yourself to be one of the real experts in how to move the needle when you talk about, and let's talk about 404, wetland permitting. And because that's been a big issue, and it was probably brewing while you were secretary, but it's one of those things where state of Florida at one point was looking at assuming those responsibilities from the federal government, and then we did, and then we didn't, and then now we still aren't. First, tell me what 404 is. Tell me why it's important, and tell me why the assumption was important for the state of Florida.
So the state of Florida has a sophisticated, mature wetlands program. We call it Environmental Resource Permitting, ERP, which DEP and the Water Management Districts all participate in. And there's a tremendous amount of expertise in evaluating a wetland and issuing or denying an ERP wetlands permit. And the entire process largely mirrors what the Army Corps does with their 404 wetlands program.
Right.
And so I know when we were at DEP, Jeff Littlejohn went to Congress and testified about Florida's sophisticated wetlands protection program. And at the time, the state of Florida spent more on their wetlands program than the Army Corps did nationally.
Wow.
We tried to make our case that the state of Florida was well prepared to take over the 404 program. That was during the time that President Obama was our chief executive. That administration was not as interested.
Right. That's the first I'd heard that. It's like, and I've read articles, some of which you've written, and Jeff have written, you know, over the years. That's the first time I've ever heard that. What I think is an important note, at least for me, to hear in terms of the why doing it is, if the state of Florida is spending more on that program in and of itself than the federal government did the rest of the country combined, that's an incredible thing to contemplate. And then for somebody to not be interested in that seems curious.
For whatever reason, the federal government has chosen not to allow states to assume that program, the 404 wetlands program, like they have for all the other programs.
Well, there are a few exceptions, right?
So Michigan and New Jersey are the two states that have a 404 program. And I think they're operating fine. I don't know. I can guarantee you one thing, that they don't have the budget that the citizens of Florida provide DEP and the Water Management District to regulate the wetlands.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. Since its inception in 2014, Sea and Shoreline's unmatched experience with scientifically validated methods of aquatic restoration has proven successful across more than 150 environmental projects. The company continues to be the industry leader in rehabilitating threatened and corrupted aquatic environments with proven success in places such as Crystal River, Homosassa River, the Caloosahatchee River, and the Indian River Lagoon. I've seen firsthand how Sea and Shoreline completely reset the ecosystem in Crystal River, transforming from a mucky, algae-dominated system to one with plants that actually belong there. The water used to be full of lingbia and hydrilla, with a thick bottom layer of muck that smelled like rotten eggs. But with Sea and Shoreline's comprehensive muck removal and planting of native eelgrasses, the system is now beautiful, crystal clear, with lush eelgrass meadows. The manatees are feasting, fish have returned, ecotourism is booming, and property values have significantly increased. Sea and Shoreline is committed to restoring and preserving Florida's communities and aquatic ecosystems because they're Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to help your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation.
Talk about the process of us getting it. State of Florida, eventually, you have a change in administration. Mm-hmm. They're more amenable, I think. I want to say Matt Leopold, Megan Seward, some other folks like that who were involved at the time, working with at the federal government. I think Matt was there, wasn't he?
Matt Leopold was at one time with us. Great friend, was DEP's general counsel. Mm-hmm. And his experience was from the Department of Justice. He had been focused on environmental issues before he returned to the state of Florida. He and his wife, Kim, are native Floridians and wanted to come home. And so we were proud to welcome Matt to be the general counsel for DEP. And as luck would have it, the first Trump administration selected Matt, and of course it's a Senate confirmed position, U.S. Senate, to be the general counsel for EPA. So he comes to the table with an intimate knowledge of how much Florida regulates wetlands and our focus on wetland protection.
And so tell us where we are now.
So on February the 15th of 2024, a federal judge in D.C. decided that the assumption package that the federal government approved was insufficient. Overnight, the Army Corps wound up with the entire 404 program for the state of Florida in their lap. So DEP, that had the program and the people, the hundreds of people,
right,
to process those permits, ultimately wound up in the Army Corps' lap after they had reassigned people, their 404 reviewers.
Right.
And it was a real challenge for the Army Corps leadership in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. They're good friends, and it was a challenge. They got real creative. They used folks that were outside the state of Florida, actually, mm-hmm, to assist with permit processing, because at the time, and the state of Florida was booming. Mm-hmm. So you just had an extraordinary number of permits that just like a piano dropped on their head.
And I think, and often I was like, I have my moments where, you know, I myself am critical of the Army Corps of Engineers, but sometimes it's more understandable in terms of the things, the mission that they're given, and like what you're talking about, that changes at any given moment, and they just have to adjust whether or not they were prepared for it, whether or not they have the staffing for it. I think I heard at least one, I think maybe two different cases where I heard of permit reviewers that they pulled in from as far away as New Mexico, you know, having to work on these. I can feel sympathetic for, you know, where they sit, but it seemed like, at least for me, it's like there's a solution to it. When I was at Northwest Florida Water Management at the time, when we were looking at the issue and try, basically just defending the good name, you know, of our own, you know, wetlands program, was how many times the delineation that, you know, our regulatory folks at the district had something, had a line that was changed by the folks from the Corps that had to come in after the fact, or the state to come after the fact, to draw their own line and make their own determination. And never once, not once, was that line different than the federal government's line for wetlands, which means you're only talking about how much mitigation needs to be done that's decided by the state and federal government. And it seemed bewildered by the idea that if you know you can trust folks to comply with the law the way it is, why you want to put the good folks at the Corps, those hardworking folks, through that kind of turmoil?
It was certainly, it was hard on all the regulators.
Yeah.
Because DEP had to transition all those permit applications back to the Corps. And you made the comment about permit reviewers that work for the Army Corps in New Mexico.
Right.
Obviously, they weren't flying to Florida to move flags that the water management districts had placed.
Right.
It was a challenge, but that's, the Army Corps was trying to be resourceful to climb out of the hole that they were in. And even now, 2 years later, I think they're understaffed. Obviously, when a water management district or DEP, they have a direct ear to the legislature and the governor, and if the resources are needed, they have an easier opportunity to make their case than, say, an outpost for the Army Corps in Jacksonville.
I want to move on. I mean, I could talk about and complain, I think would be probably closer, about that for another hour or two, but I've kept you a long time, but I don't want to let you escape without asking you about where the waters of the U.S., the Sackett cases, where that issue is now. Can you give people just a hair of a background on what was going on there, where it is, and what that means in terms of people's lives, property owners' lives, regulators' lives in Florida?
So when Congress passed the Clean Water Act, they gave a certain amount of authority to EPA and the Corps of Engineers to regulate waters. Originally, it was what you and I, well, what the average person on the street would think is waters and just the adjacent wetlands. Mm-hmm. And over time, depending upon the administration, the scope of the regulation creeped. And I think there's been five different U.S. Supreme Court cases that had to deal with, well, what is the extent of the federal government's authority to regulate wetlands? And the most recent one was Sackett, where all nine justices decided that the scope of regulation that EPA and the Corps were doing was outside the scope of the authority given to them by Congress.
Huh.
So they disagreed on where that line should be.
Sure.
But all nine agreed that the regulations in place at that time were illegal.
Mm.
And the challenge has been is Congress gave a certain amount of authority to regulate wetlands, and so often as regulators you say, yes, but what about these other wetlands over here? So let's try from an administrative standpoint to regulate those. Too often, unfortunately, the debate is centered upon, are those wetlands valuable? But I think this court started focusing better than most. The issue is not whether those wetlands are valuable or not. It's what authority did Congress give the Army Corps and EPA to regulate those wetlands? Because really the basic fundamental of the Clean Water Act is the states would have primacy in regulation.
Right.
I'm sure that just bored everybody to death, Brett.
It did not. Well, it didn't me. And so the rest of you out there just come along for the ride. But we do need to let you go. But I've got to ask you the same questions or similar questions that I ask everyone. And let's start with, are you optimistic about the future of Florida's environment? And why or why not?
I am optimistic. I think folks are more focused on the environment now than they were 15 years ago, particularly in the septic tank arena. We explored further regulation of septic tanks 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and there just wasn't the appetite. And I think now the citizenry is realizing, and the elected officials are realizing, that you can't have a third of the population using 100-year-old technology, which is what a septic tank is. Sure. It's a hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And expect to have clean water. And not every septic tank's bad. If you're on a, you know, larger lot, the environment can accommodate that. But we have certain areas of the state where thousands of people are on quarter-acre lots with septic tanks. And sadly, we're still adding about 40,000 new septic tanks each year.
Yeah, that was something that you told me a couple of times, but it surprised me. It captures the imagination where, you know, folks like myself who had worked with DEP, with Drew Bartlett, with Angela Connect and Adam Blaylock and others to improve water quality, to move from these traditional septic systems to something better. And then you realize that you're playing a tug of war, that sometimes you're working from behind. And certainly that has to be the case in the Panhandle, which is where, you know, my milieu, so to speak, was not as big of an issue as looking at West Central Florida, East Central Florida, Southeast Florida, where you have 100,000, 200,000 septic tanks in a county, and you're adding more than you're taking out. And
that's what's extraordinary is my recollection is we have, you see, I'm such a joy at cocktail parties. I think we have 216,000 septic tanks in Miami-Dade. A fair number of them go underwater twice a day when the tide comes up.
That's fun.
That's not a winning solution for improved water quality.
Yeah, I guess, maybe, does that answer question number two, which was, what, if anything, keeps you up at night? What do you worry about when it comes to the environment in Florida? Is it the, how do we solve the issue of dealing with wastewater?
I do. With a state with 23 million people and growing, we do not have the traditional infrastructure in place, nor will we, to accommodate the folks that are already here, much less the folks that are coming. So I'm certainly hopeful that technology, and I do think that technology will save the day as people start studying this program. And it's not peculiar to Florida. You have parts of New York City, Suffolk County, where they're still using cesspits.
Right.
And you think, are you kidding me?
Right.
This has been, there are people been living there, or at least the Europeans have been living there since the 1600s.
Right.
Surely they have a more sophisticated way to handle wastewater, but they don't.
I always find that amusing as well in thinking about places like Long Island, which is where Suffolk County is, and what they use. Like, I thought we were supposed to be the troglodytes down here in Florida. And as much as we could use improvement here, to know that there are places that are doing it even worse or even have more to catch up on, and don't invest the resources that Florida does, whether it was when you were at DEP before or since. There's a lot of money to get spent on these things, and compared to other places, it's interesting to think about. Anyway, I'm taking away from your answers here. So one last question. Mm-hmm. Young person, some kid at LSU or Florida State or University of Florida is thinking about getting involved in the environmental field as a living. What advice do you give to that person?
Well, I can't think of a better place to get terrific training than the state of Florida. Hmm. Both DEP and the water management districts are really jewels. A lot of committed people that work there, that have been there for decades, that are eager to share their knowledge and how to follow the law.
What is true, I've seen it and still see it. I think that's a great place to stop.
I have one more thing.
Heck yeah.
I have a dollar in my pocket. And it was given to me by John Steverson. And he wanted me to let your listeners know that he is the best turkey hunter in the state of Florida.
I hear his stories about turkey hunting, so I'll take him at his word on that. But you just heard it from HTV himself. Herschel Vineyard, thank you so much for coming on the show. Appreciate your time.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use. And don't forget to leave that 5-star rating and a review even. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod. And you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com with your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of the podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he has to work with, and to Dave Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance, as always. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free, and you should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.